D72 is the professional PC text multi-tool designed for automation in diagnostic, Windows repair, and malware removal. No other tool can help you automate more, relax more, and get paid with less effort than ever. Podnuts likes to thank Nick Shaw for his continued support.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Geeksters episode 124. It's Tim. It's Martin. It's the Geekster Show. Guys, this is a show about geeksters and geekery and anything geekific. I don't even know if that's a word. We've created some words on here, but I don't think I can make terrific into a geekster word. I don't know. It's worth a shot.
Mad terrific.
BT dubs. This is going to be off the hook. I'm just trying. I'm trying real hard. It's not working. So, my name is Martin Obando. You guys know me. I'm going to introduce my co-host with the power, Tim Bauermeister.
Hey, man. I'm fully gruntled today.
Awesome. You know, it's been a good day here, too.
That's it.
I went out for coffee, had some talks, was able to just sit around today. I got a little bit of work done. I had a update that started to go wrong last night and then went right.
How so?
That was, I don't know if you have ever used the ACT software.
I have, but I am somewhat familiar with it.
So, okay. I don't use it myself either, but I have a client who uses it, and there was an update, and I was notified of this update last Thursday. So I said, sure, no problem. So Thursday night, I tried to update it, and it doesn't work well. I don't have the username and password. All right. So I get the username and password again on Friday. It doesn't work well. It just won't take the username and password. So then we try to do some stuff, and then over the weekend, I try to get another username and password. It doesn't work. So last night, I finally got the right username and password, and what it was I was missing, because I tried it with one password, username, it didn't work, another password, username, and then it was just a space. There was this username actually has a space in it, which that's kind of odd. I usually don't find passwords or usernames with spaces in them.
Yeah, I mean, a space as a character in a password, it's unusual.
Well, or I mean, in a username either.
Oh, I see. Okay. Is it accounting software? What is it? I'm trying to remember.
It's a database software.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's like contacts, and it interfaces with Outlook, and it interfaces with QuickBooks, and so you can have one database in a business environment with all your contacts and client information and notes, and then it interfaces across the board, so you just have to update one spot, and it can go to QuickBooks, and it go to your Outlook and all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
So last night I go to update this client or this ACT. I finally get it. I can log in now. Yay. I back up the password or back up the database. I go to run it. Not enough space on the C drive. Open up the C drive. It's a 40 gig hard drive. So it's a 2008 R2. It came with a 40 gig partition for the C drive. And then it had out of a 500 gig hard drive. So the rest of it was for the D drive. Note to self and note to users. When you buy a, server, through whatever your choice of manufacturer are, and they do give you the option to partition out your OS drive, do that. That's fine, but make sure you make it big. Really, I've noticed that 40 gigs is not enough room. I've been running out of 40 gig space in 2008. 2012, I'm assuming, takes more, so at least go with the 80, and then you can adjust from there. But definitely don't get the small. Go ahead and go big. So had to upload an application, and I've used what's the application I use? Sorry, long pause.
The application to do what?
It's a partition manager. I can't type and click at the same time. It's Partition Magic, actually. There it is. Partition Magic has a server edition. And what this will do is you can go ahead and you can move partitions around, and then you hit apply, and it just does this thing in the background. The problem is that when it does it in the background, the server goes offline. And when I'm remoting into these servers, I have to wait. So about 2.5 hours later, and that's the scary part, is the server is offline. You can ping it from another server, but you don't have remote desktop to it. My screens connect doesn't connect to it, and you just kind of wait. And it's that moment of, I hope it reboots and hope it comes back online. So about 2 hours later, right. 2.5 hours later, bing, it comes back online. Great. Now I have an 80 gig partition, trunk of the other stuff. I go to do the update. Update does everything fine. No problems with that. And then I actually do a document and I screenshot as I'm doing updates, because then I hand that to the clients. And to this morning, on each one of their machines, they had to update their local version of ACT. And they just followed the screenshots. I had one gentleman who needed to do some backup for another database. One little hiccup there, no problem. And then I had one gentleman who called because he also ran out of room. For some reason, this is the reason what I ran into is Act likes to, you download Act, it does a full uninstaller, and it needs some enormous amount of room before it installs, and then it gets rid of all of it, gets rid of itself. But it needed, I mean, so my friend had, and I don't know how this works, if it's the temp folder or what. So this client had like 200 gigabytes available on his hard drive. And what happened was, is it said we still needed 300 and some megabytes of available space. We emptied his recycle bin, which had some old PST files and stuff. So there was like 2 gigs in there. We got rid of the recycle bin and it ran just fine.
Good.
But why wouldn't they use the other 200 gigs that were available on his hard drive? But it worked. So those were the only two updates. Everybody else said great. Actually, the owner of the company who knows how to use computers, but he admittedly says he struggles. He said, thank you so much for the documentation, because it was screenshots and click next, click here, you know, with all of these screenshots, and he was very pleased with it. So,
well, okay. And so what version of server was this?
This was a 2008 R2 server.
Okay. So, and well, let me ask you this. I mean, because starting with Vista, as I recall, I mean, building to Windows was a very capable method of resizing partitions. Is that the case also in server or no? Because I'll tell you what, I mean, like Partition Magic and Gpart and all those, I've always used those because I found them to be very convenient and easy. But, I mean, once they introduced that in the Vista, I mean, it was still somewhat limited. You still could not do certain things. However, generally, it would do what I would need to do as far as resizing partitions. And I was just curious, does it have that function within server or no?
Well,
I don't know.
I want to say no because I know in 2003 it does not. So I want to say that it doesn't, or I wouldn't have had to use this application, because I've had to use this application before on another server to do the same thing to get more room on the C drive. I have one 2012 server that maybe later on during the show when you have are talking, I can jump in and take a look at that one. But right now I'm looking at it, the 2008 R2 server. Actually, the server I was on last night, just to see if it does have that in its under the hard drive. What is it? The hard drive tools. So I'll continue on to that.
Gotcha.
One.
You know, and this that actually reminds me of another use for a tool that I've mentioned here before, is that when you start that process in Windows of it resizing its partitions, you know, the very first thing it wants to do is, you know, query for just the potential. What can it do? What can it do? And it goes through and starts analyzing the files and everything. And generally, you know, what it's doing is it's looking for, where system, you know, folders are, files and such. So, you know, it's looking for like the page file business is and the recycle bin and all these other types of things that are, you know, generally hidden and take up a lot of space, and but you're really not aware of them. And so, you know, it might say, well, I can only do this much. And you're thinking, why is that? Because I see all this available. It's free and whatever, but basically it just needs enough room to shuffle those big things around. And I have found that I can get Windows to choose. I can get Windows to do what I want to do when sometimes it thinks it can't. So I've mentioned Ultimate Defragmenter before, and that's from DiskTrix.com, DiskTrix. I think it's the best defragmenter available ever. That's just my personal opinion. I've used it a million times. But one of the things I can do with it is that I can actually say, hey, I only want you to move these files to these places. And so generally I can move those things around in such a way that Windows is all of a sudden sees a lot more opportunity and will then be capable of maybe adjusting those partitions the way, you know, I want them to, where maybe originally it thought it could not. However, having, you know, I still love the Gpart and the Partition Magic and all those, the bootable disks. However, if Windows has a tool in it, sometimes it's I've always found it to be quite capable. Sometimes it's nice to be able to work within Windows to get things done. So I just wanted to mention that. Right. I've forgotten that use for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's what I run into.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that a 40 gig partition is, that's awful, especially when you have, and I've complained about it before, we have applications that, by default, they want to store large data folders, you know, in or around their program folder under program files. I understand that, you know, software has to, they have to code it in such a way that it stores it to the C drive, because generally that's the way most systems are set up. However, we usually build our own systems just because we want to make things the way we want them. It's no longer a way of saving money like it used to be. But it makes so much sense to have a C partition with just your system files on, all your data folders on a different partition, because it makes reinstalling so much easier. Yeah. So that's what we do, but then we end up, you know, getting in trouble because you get Chrome installs in a weird place. And, well, then again, I mean, Chrome, that's in an app folder. So if you have your document settings moved to the data partition, that's different. I'm trying to think of what some of the others are. I know I've gotten in trouble with the... Well, I mean, it's just customers' computers. Actually, when they call and they have a partition that's empty, a huge, you know, huge bit of data space, but they're constantly being harangued about being out of space. And so, you know, these programs, they can store the stuff wherever they want, but at the same time, they should make it easy to move their data folders wherever you actually want them, if you do choose to have them elsewhere. So.
Yeah. So I'm on that. I'm in the server, and I realize. So yes, 2008 R2 does have. Under the disk management, you can move and shrink and resize partitions. In Dells, though, this is what I'm finding in Dells. So I have the recovery partition is 3 gigs, and then right next to that I have the C drive, which is, you know, whatever space. And then there's this little bit of unallocated space. It's less than a gig, or, you know, unallocated space. And then I have the D drive, and then I have some more unallocated space at the other side. If you shrink in Windows, if you shrink a partition, it grabs it from the back.
Right.
And I want it from the front.
Right.
Because so that's why I needed a third party tool. I guess I could move the unallocated space. You know what I mean? I guess I could shrink one, grab the unallocated space that sits in between that, make that bigger, and then turn around and then grab the C drive and do all that. Partition Magic, I just move everything around and does what it does, and I hit apply and it goes and goes. So it sounds like, yes, there are free spaces. Like there's some space, there's some unallocated space at the very end of this hard drive that's just sitting there. I could grab that and throw that on behind the D drive and it would be fine. But I don't think there's a very easy way to go ahead and say, I need data from the front of D, keep the unallocated space the same because apparently it's there for some reason. And then I just need to shift everything over. And I think Windows doesn't make that very easy.
Right. And I think that was the limitation that, you know, I referred to earlier. One of the limitations it has is that, you know, it'll gladly do something in one direction, but not the other or both. And so that's where the third-party partition managers come in real handy.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, I mean, so I got that done last night, but it was, you know, it turned out to be I wanted to go to sleep. I wasn't feeling very good yesterday. And, you know, I said, I'm going to go to bed early. And early turned into 12:30. Which isn't early. Early for me was going to be, I was going to hope to go to bed about like 9:30. But it is what it is. So,
but it worked. So
it works. It's up and running.
So it could have been really late.
Right. And well, yes, it could have been, or really early. Yeah. But you know, but now it's, you know, two birds with one stone. I was able to get the update done, and I knew they were running out of drive on this. I knew they were running out of hard drive space on the C drive. I was just kind of, I was babying it along, getting a couple gigs here and then deleting, you know, like the hibernation files of this, you know, and then I don't know why it created a hibernation file at one time. Somebody must have put it in hibernate mode on a server, and kind of babying it along. And then it was just like, well, okay, I have to get this other project done. It requires getting this thing done. So let's just do it all. Now they have 40 gigs of free space and their update. And, you know, it's better. It's another thing off my to-do list that I don't have to worry
really
about.
That's a really unfortunate setting on a server for the hibernate.
Yes, it had a hibernation file. And I was like, all right.
Yeah, I want this to go to sleep and not be able to do anything with it remote. Don't do that.
Yeah.
That's just bizarre to me.
Yeah. Mitch just joined us in the chat room. Hey, Mitch, it's good to see you. Mitch was unable to make it. He had a little bit of a flood in his home. And as everybody, if you don't know where he broadcasts from, when you see him, it's kind of in one of the lower levels. And luckily, all of his computers were offline, but he had quite a bit of water damage. And so they have to get it all dried out. And this happened earlier this week or late last week. It just, man, when he said that his house got flooded, and it just, that was not good. Not good at all. Mitch, you're supposed to power wash the outside of the home. I'm just saying.
Oh, boy. He's a real tough guy when you're not on, huh, Mitch? Why don't you come on here and let him have it?
I know. Sorry, Mitch. All right.
But remember, Mitch, God promised he wouldn't destroy the world with a flood again. It'll be fire. So that's what you need to look out for. Water's okay.
There you go. Fire. Reminds me of those Geico commercials. All right. All right. So today, the big news from today, it doesn't matter if NSA and the whole issue with net neutrality was going on today. No. That doesn't matter. Nothing else matters.
Right.
Weird Al released his new album today.
There you go.
So I've been geeking out on the Weird Al album. It's called Mandatory Fun. Been a big Weird Al fan. If you go to weirdal.com, you can go in there. And every day, starting yesterday to today, he's been releasing videos. Yesterday was a parody of Happy by Will Ferrell. And today it was called Tacky. And today is one called Grammar Words. Word Crimes, which is a parody of Blurred Lines. And it's pretty funny. So go check it out. If you're a big Weird Al fan, check it out. If you don't, I don't even know why you're listening to us.
You know what I found with Weird Al is that it's, first of all, this guy has had some staying power. I mean, he really has. You know, he's never been like at, you know, the penultimate of stardom or, but he's maintained. And I mean, this guy, his first album came out, I think 79 maybe. You know, I've actually discovered that when I first started listening to the guy, I was too young to know any of the songs that he was parodying, and I'm now too old to know any of the songs that he's making parodies of. I've literally lived like an entire, I'm in the like a lifetime, a Weird Al lifetime, and you know, and he's just kept going. So some of his stuff I've always found uneven. So I was like, yeah, some of it's great, some of it's just kind of okay, but yeah. You just can't go wrong with. The polka compilation song. Every album usually has a polka compilation song, right? Where it just takes bits of popular songs from the last year or so and puts them to polka music, and that's always a winner, always. So
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. There was a couple of things I wanted to mention last week that I couldn't remember, and so this week it was. I was like, oh, that's, I need to write those down. So a couple of things that happened to me, I guess it would have been a couple weeks ago. It was, I think it was before the 4th of July, is that I use on my Linux box, I use a program, and you can do it with other programs, but I use a Google syncing program because I use Google Docs, and it's called InSync, InSync. I think I've talked about it before, but it does basically the Google Drive sync locally to my machine because there's not a native Google app program yet. There's other ones that have come out, but this one seems to work really well. You pay a flat fee per account, and you can sync multiple accounts. So I have multiple accounts of Google syncing, and one of them is my business account. And I use Google Forms. And if you've never used Google Forms, it's a great way to go ahead and create a way to submit data, and it puts it in Excel spreadsheet. So I use it for mileage, for my time card, for deposits, withdrawals, etc. And the reason I do that is because then I put them in a Google Doc that's locked. My bookkeeper then grabs that data, puts it into QuickBooks, and does all my bookkeeping with it. I needed to reload my machine a while ago. So when I reloaded my machine, I set up InSync, and then it started to download and basically re-download all my data because, like I said, in the forms, you have the form itself, and then you have the database that it attaches to, and there's some magic voodoo that happens between the two. And you know, if you've ever worked with a database before and stuff, there's a linking process, and there's usually some kind of a security key that goes between the linking. And if you break the key, then you've broken the link, and then it's all messed up. And so a lot of times if you're syncing something, you have your local copy and then you have your sync copy, you'll break the link to go do something, you'll want to recreate it, and then you think, well, I'll just take my local copy and I'll put it back in where it used to be, like Dropbox, say. And then now I'll save bandwidth by putting my local copy in there, and then it syncs and says, oh, I don't need to sync everything off the cloud because I already see it local. That doesn't work in Google Docs. That doesn't work at all, especially when there's forms involved. It will work for the docs, but it will not work for forms. So out of my genius, I said, not a problem. I'm going to throw my forms in there, and then it starts to download it. And now wait, now I'm getting versioning. I'm getting copied one, copy two. Oh, I don't need copy two. I delete copy two. That was the original copy. And anyways, all my forms are host. So I thought, well, this really stinks, but I can get to the data. I just don't have the way of doing any forms. I was able to export all my data. It was the end of the month, so we just kind of let it ride. I remember that. So yeah, it was a while ago. Talked to my accountant and said, here, I'm just going to give you the Excel spreadsheet because I could export it, give it to her. She could do everything she needs to do to it while I rebuild the forms. So I go to rebuild the forms, And they've made it a lot better. The one of the things that I have is I have a drop down list of all my clients, and being my I like everything in alphabetical order. And so what would happen is I'd have 30 or so in alphabetical order, and then it would just be a hodgepodge as I brought new clients on. Now what you can do is you can actually put out your data in and then move the cells up and down. You can rearrange them. So that's pretty nice. And you can highlight. So I took all my clients, I put them all in like a spreadsheet just so I could have them in alphabetical order. And I was going to just basically have to copy, paste. Well, what they don't tell you is you can select all, go into the first cell, right click, paste. And it just whoop, fills it all in for you in Google Docs. Saved. That was the biggest headache and heartache that I was going to have to deal with, was putting in all like 150 of my clients again, one by one. And not just on one spreadsheet, because I use them for my withdrawals and I use them for my deposits and I use them for my time card. So there's three sheets that I have to do that to. That was, you know, that's a whole lot of data.
Yeah.
Of copying and pasting. And nope, right click, paste. So if you've never used Google Forms before and you're looking for an easy way to take a survey, to just put some data in the spreadsheet, check out the new version of Google Docs Forms. They're pretty slick. They've done quite a bit of stuff to it now.
Hey, in the Google Apps tip of the day, you kind of made me think of this. I'll throw this one out too. Something I discovered that maybe everybody knows this, and I just happened to discover it. But if you use Hangouts at all in the Hangout app, it doesn't take long for it to be unmanageable as far as scrolling back and finding, you know, posts or information or links or something that someone has posted, and it can really be difficult. So it doesn't matter how many Hangouts you have, how old they are. You can go into your Gmail, and you can search your Hangouts from Gmail the same way you would search your Gmail, but it'll search your Hangouts as well, and so you can locate information that way, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Now the problem, the one thing that I have with that is that I don't use Gmail natively. I use it through Thunderbird.
Right.
But that doesn't mean I can't just open up Gmail and just search for it.
Right. It's very easy, and often I'm like, okay, well, I know somebody posted this piece of information that I want, you know, 10 days ago, but you start scrolling and you scroll and you scroll, and it only loads, I think, you know, seven posts at a time. It's like, gosh, it still take forever. And so yeah, it was fantastic when I found that. And not only that, but you know, once you discover something like that, and then you find what you need, then you're like, I wonder what else I can find. So you start playing around with it, and it's amazing. I mean, the thing was going back to the beginning of my Hangouts when I was using it well over a year ago, and I was finding all kinds of interesting things I'd forgotten about.
Oh, that's cool. Is there a site or anything that talks about that?
Yeah, it's right here. It's podnuts.com. The Geeksters, we're talking about it right now. I would imagine that somewhere, if you,
I'm gonna tweet that.
Somewhere there is some, you know, somewhere explain that. But I just happened to discover. I just went searching my Gmail for something else, and I was like, oh, well, look at this. I'm getting my Hangout. I'm getting Hangout results, and I'm like, wow. So I searched for that thing, sure enough, it very quickly found exactly what I needed. So it was a link that somebody had done. So
I found it.
Yeah,
I found a support. It says your Hangout history in Gmail. And it tells you how to do it, and I also it'll be in the chat as well.
Yeah, ta-da.
So speaking of Google tips, I have one, and right. this one kind of floored me. I was a little uneasy about this one because it just shows kind of where we are as far as what our phones are doing and kind of the lack of privacy. So if you go to maps.google.com, if you're signed into your Gmail account that your this is for Android phones, that your Android phone is attached to, okay, then go to maps.google.com/location history. It will tell you where you've been, and it will show you where you've been, and you can go back days, and it has a timeline and a scroll bar on the bottom, and it starts at like 2 a.m. Let me pull it up. So maps.google.com/location history. So Tim, if you want to jump there as well, like I said, be signed into your account that you use. So today, I'm looking at the 15th, and it starts at midnight. And it has a drag bar, and right about 8 a.m., it kind of looks like a, so you have time across the bottom and then distance up vertically, okay? Time horizontally, distance vertically, and then the distance then starts to move up and down as you travel, okay? So if I use the scroll bar and at 2 a.m. nothing happened, 4 a.m. nothing happened, 6 a.m. nothing happened, it looks like my phone's moving around, and that's probably because, and it will actually move around when you're at home. So if I'm up and I'm walking around the house with my phone, it shows movement. And then it shows me at 8 a.m. what I did. And it shows me at 8 a.m. I went to, on the map, it draws a red line, shows me where I went. And then I can show, oh, then it shows me, okay, I followed this route and this route. And it actually will follow you on the street maps and show you time where you've been. And then back and forth, it shows I was at a coffee shop for a while, moving around. And so it shows my little red dot kind of jiggling in the same location. And then right about 10 o'clock, it shows me I came down this certain street and then back. Some of it is a little particular. Some of it knows exactly where you've gone. It'll follow the streets, and the other ones it won't. So today, I went to a coffee shop, had a meeting. I came back down, almost got all the way home, and then I remembered, oh, wait, I need to go buy tickets for a movie tonight. I turned around, and it shows my red map, my dot, going, getting close to my home, and then 180-ing and going back the other direction. And I was like, what did I do? Well, so then I go, okay, well, let's look at, you know, Monday, June 30th. And all of a sudden, it shows this huge, big, giant map of the city, and I can start and go, oh, okay, 8 a.m., I left, I went up, I went to the freeway, and then I was in downtown for a while, and then I shot back down to this other location, which I know that's one of my clients, and then I shot back to the freeway, and, you know, and then I go back home. And then later on, it shows me going back up. Well, I had a baseball game that night, or a softball game. So this is kind of, like I said, it's kind of cool because you can go, oh, what did I do on that day, and where did I go? But on the other hand, your phone's watching you. Your phone is tracking your location history, and you can go back in time and see where you've been. I don't know how long it goes back. June 2nd apparently works quite well. April 1st. Yep, April 1st is still showing some stuff. So you can go in and delete all your history. You can show your timestamps, and you can look at that. But Google.com or maps.google.com/location history. It's kind of weird. Yeah. It's a little, like I said, it's cool, but on the other hand, it's a little Big Brotherish.
I actually have no location history when I go there, but I would assume it's because I have that feature disabled on the phone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I always.
I didn't
always,
know I had it enabled.
Yeah, I that's something that it asked you, but at some point, but I'm sure that I disabled thinking that felt kind of Big Brotherish. It's like I know where I am. I don't need it to remind me. And this thing, 2 weeks later, it's like I. Oh, actually, that might be good because I can't remember where I've been.
So I don't know if it would work well for, for ingressing. It says that I can show 30 days, and I don't know what that looks like. It's still working, but you can show a day at a time in your time map. But it looks like you can show 30 days. Yeah. So here it is. I can show from. It's pretty cool. You can show a whole month view. And it'll do the same thing. So you can scroll along the bottom in time and watch what you've done in the whole month. And it actually is kind of cool because in March, and then all of a sudden it shows me going to, this is in 2014. I went somewhere. Looks like I must have gone over to Columbus. Oh no, I was in Chicago. I did something. Oh no, I was going to OLF. Yeah. So it shows me, my map shows me going to Chicago, to Boston, back to San Francisco, back to Oregon. Anyways, it's kind of freaky, but kind of cool at the same time.
That's cool. I didn't realize that that information was you could access like that and that it's laid out on a map. That's very cool. What's the application? What do you do with that? I mean, to me, it's a curiosity, but what's a practical application for that? What do you think? Any ideas kind of
for knowing that data? Oh. Well, I guess if you wanted to monitor somebody.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. It's useful monitoring somebody else, but is it useful? How is it useful to me? I'm thinking.
Well, if you don't know, so as a business owner, I don't know, I don't remember what I did yesterday, but I can go, oh, okay, I went to this location and I went over here, then may spring some ideas. I think you can use it for mileage. So if you forget how far you drove the other day, you can at least get a ballpoint and then remap it out with a Google Maps and get mileage.
Okay.
I don't know, maybe if you have.
You know what I'd use it for?
Just can't remember.
I'd use it for an alibi.
Well, you'd have to get rid of your phone. I'm sorry. I was thinking you'd use it for an alibi for something you did, not to protect yourself from false accusation. You could take your phone and strap it to your dog like they did in Police Academy.
Oh, okay.
Remember the flashlight?
Then, all right. Yeah.
And just let your dog go, go, go be, go run, run.
I just throw it in a boxcar going past.
Yeah, my alibi says I was on my way to Kalamazoo.
Yeah, that's right. I was in Detroit Rail Yards. I don't know why, but I was.
Yes, I was there for 4 hours. Thank you very much.
Apparently, I'm still there.
Exactly. I'm not here right now.
I am not the Tim you are looking for.
You are the Tim.
I'm one of them.
You're one of them. Anyway. So what have you been up to? What is your fiscal week?
A lot of more of the same. I'll tell you what. This is actually kind of a good opportunity. I'd like to kind of just comment on some software that we've reviewed before, because I'm finding them quite handy. As always, ADW Cleaner, awesome. Get that from Bleeping Computer, as well as Junkware Removal Tool, JRT. Those two work very well hand in hand, cleaning up the systems. You know, a lot of the malware that we see now is really, it has the same effect as malware, but it's really just, it's more like death by a thousand paper cuts, and it's all self-inflicted with toolbars and all these other ridiculous things. I know that that's what I see a lot. And so, I'll admit I see a lot more of that than proper malware, which just suits me. I mean, I feel better about removing stuff that's self-inflicted as opposed to somebody just got tricked or really taken advantage of. And it's fairly easy to remove. Usually using those two programs, you can get out most of it, and running malware bytes tends to clean up the rest of it. So, I'm liking that. You know, there was something that I think maybe Mitch brought it. I don't remember. You tell me, but do you remember Unchecky?
Yes, I was going to bring that up.
Right. Was that you or was that him?
I think I may have done it. But so when I was at my in-laws' house.
I still love it.
4th of July. Yeah. Well, what happens with her is I was there for the 4th of July, and then I came back to pick up my kids, last week, last Friday. What's happening is I'll clean out her computer, and then it'll get infected again. Yeah. And all she's doing is she's playing games. Well, she's going to this one website, and she's just downloading games. And I think the games themselves are not harmful. What's happening is the games are installing junk with it. And she's just hitting next, 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 next. And I thought this would be a great time to put in Unchecky.
Yeah.
Because it needs to, that would just keep her from, having to uncheck anything and just do it automatically for her, because she doesn't need McAfee system scan and, right. Whatever.
Ask toolbar.
Yeah, and rate this site.com. Yeah, so unchecky.com. Thank you for that in the chat. It rhymed. It took me for a loop. But yeah, Unchecky.
Oh, it didn't put in the, okay, I see. Yeah, somehow it registered me as that. Anyway, I messed up.
Oh, you're that.
Yeah, I'm that.
Oh, thank you, that.
There was more. Apparently, it didn't like spaces, but I'm that. Today, I'm that. Sometimes I'm this, sometimes I'm that.
I'm glad I didn't say anything out loud. I'm like, who chooses a dumb name like that? Literally. Oh, it's hey, Tim.
I hate computers. I really do.
I didn't even know you were there.
I truly hate computers. Yeah, today I am that. So, yeah, I'm checking. But it's great. It's great, isn't it?
I'm still getting a kick out of that.
Stupid. I know. I'm stupid.
No, I just think it's funny because I didn't know it was you.
Oh, it's me. You can tell. If something's screwed up somehow, I'm I should be pointed at. I should be questioned. You know, but the thing about Unchecky is that it was kind of like, first of all, it's horrible that we're at a point in this world that we actually need such a thing. But the second thing is that it's kind of like, it's so specific. It's such a specific thing. And it's not something that you require very often. I really want to install this because it's something I'm going to forget about. And if something bad happens with it, I will find that things are broken and I won't know why. And I'll have trouble tracing back to this because I forgot about it. But you know what? Every time there's a flash install, whatever, upgrade, any of these things, I'm like, well, look at that. All those boxes are unchecked. And then I'm like, oh, that's right. I got Unchecky. And so it's been, I don't know how long ago that was, but I mean, it's still a relevant program. It's still working. I still love it. I don't install it on customers' computers or anything like that, but I use it on my own machines and I love it. It's great.
I'm going to have to install it and try it out because I don't have it installed, but I'm installing my mother-in-law system.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no better test bed to experiment with than on your mother-in-law's machine.
Well, I mean, she's not out to do harm. She's not going to sites. She plays games,
yep.
And they're flash-based games, and 90% of the flash-based games have stuff that Unchecky would be very useful. Because I do. I mean, she's running the full version of Malwarebytes. She's running CryptoPrevent. You know, she's running Microsoft Security Essentials. So she's up to date and she's secure. I've never seen a virus on her computer. She's just getting all of this garbage.
Okay, so I'm seeing where there's been some bad press. Now, I searched around a little bit for it. I didn't see anything. But Chat room says that we do have a fellow podcaster that's not using it anymore. So I'll have to delve into that and see why. I'm curious.
Yeah, maybe I should write him an email. And he's talking about Mike Smith from the Mike Tech Show, and, which is a great, great
good
show.
Good guy and a great show.
I haven't. So. I don't know why I haven't. He hasn't come up on my podcast lately. I got to go back and figure out what happened with that because he used to be on. I know it was a holiday season, so I don't know. I don't know. I'll figure it out. It's not a time to do it now.
You guys weren't feuding?
No, I don't.
No tiff.
Why would I have
no
a feud
tiff involved?
Like the Jets and the Sharks on
Jets
West Side Story.
Sharks.
Is it the Sharks? Sharks? Jets and the Cats? Jets and the... I don't know what it is. I don't know. So...
It was okay, and so those were some things that I wanted to bring up, and the other thing really was that I'm kind of somewhat actively searching out a new remote desktop software solution. I still have LogMeIn, which you know it's great, I love it, it works, but it's become prohibitively expensive for what I'm using it for, and so on a lark, after doing some searching, I tried a product called AnyDesk. We talked about that here before.
We haven't. I'm a fan of Screen Connect.
Oh, that's right. And so I'm.
But that doesn't mean I'm not worried up to using something.
Yeah,
else.
I'm still. And like I said, my search isn't as active as it probably should be. But I did try this out just for kicks, and it's interesting. First of all, it's still in beta, and so it's free at this point. It will eventually be a paid program, but. One of the most interesting things about it is that it's so small. I mean, the download is just over a meg. And
oh my goodness.
Yeah, and really the way they kind of sell it is that some of the market actually shows like a handful of 3.5-inch floppy disks saying, you know, here's your download, and it goes on to say you wouldn't install it off floppies, but hey, you could if you wanted. So it's extremely small, and you can run it as a portable app. Wait a minute, I'm pretty sure you can run it as a portable app. Let me say that. But you know, it can be used and run as a one-time thing. You can run it, install it as so that it's you know always available on the remote machine. So and you can set it up with a password. And you know what's different about LogMeIn. And some of the others where it uses the same credentials as Windows has for the user accounts, you actually set up a separate name for the computer and password. And so once those are entered, you have access to the welcome screen. And from there, you then enter the Windows credentials to get you into the account that you want. And so, yeah, it's something a little bit different, but it's very small, lightweight. It runs well. I thought that it was fantastic. But having said that, it is a beta program. It will eventually cost something, and it is not feature rich in a lot of ways. And so, if you're used to having reboot options, well, those aren't available. And what I did to get around that, I don't like clicking through the start menu to reboot a machine because invariably I will click shut down accidentally at least once, and then where you at? So. I just created shortcuts on the desktop for reboot and to I made the reboot like in 15 seconds, and then I created a second shortcut to cancel that reboot in case I accidentally clicked. So that made it very easy for doing that. And to the but it did offer support for multiple screens, and so if you're logging into a machine that has multiple screens, you actually could click between the two. It's not obvious immediately how you do that, but that is available. And so, but it had all the basic stuff. You know, you could remote in, you could transfer the sound to the local computer that you're on. You know, you could copy files from the remote machine to your local machine. And, you know, just I really found it was an interesting product, and so I thought I would throw that one out there. I don't know that in the long run it will serve me, but I did find it and felt that, you know, if you need something to pinch, it's free, it's easy, it's cheap, price is right. It's worth looking into right now. AnyDesk.
Yeah, I was just looking at it, actually, and it says, right now it says AnyDesk is beta only, like you said, and it supports XP 7 and 8, and it said they are working for versions of Apple iPad from iPad Air to iPad Mini Retina, Apple Mac OS X from 10.9 Mavericks, Linux Debian-based distros, and tablets from KitKat on. So it looks like they are, you know, wanted to release something, get the word out, and from here they're going to go ahead and be making us a better product.
Yeah, and I kind of got the impression that this was a group of folks that they weren't continually adding to and attempting to improve a legacy product. You know, this is something that they said, okay, well, we wanted to do this, and starting from where we're at right now in time, how would we do it? And so they built it with that. And so I thought it was great.
It does look like if you go to their website, you can go order it. And I don't know the conversion rates, but it looks like they have a free version, which is going to be free all the time. They're going to have a light version, which is going to cost right about 200. It says 290. I think those are euros. Excuse me. 290 euros, or maybe they're... No, those are euros. 290 euros for a pay and forget is what it's called, or 60 euros charged yearly. It's a flex plan. And they're going to have a professional version, which will be at 750 for the pay and forget, or 180 a year for the flex plan. Now, the light version allows you three simultaneous connections. So that right there at whatever 290 is in... you know, what the conversion is. I don't know what the conversion is. Actually, I can tell you right now. $393, right around there. So about $394 will be your light version when it does come available, and that's U.S. dollars. So, but if you want to pay the higher one, it does have unlimited simultaneous connections. So if you are in a major business environment, you can have a lot of people involved in a lot of different projects at the same time. So. Yeah, this looks like it's going to be. It looks like this is going to give a lot of the other commercial ones that are out there a run for their money.
Well, it's another option, and I'm interested to see where it goes from here. But like I said, just trying it out once, I felt that it was adequate, and but
yeah,
not feature rich, and you were missing some things, but you know, it's just so darn small, and
1.1 meg and the is the download.
The install is just lightning quick, and it's ready to go.
Yeah, keep on that one, Tim. Because it is cross platform. So that's gonna. I mean, that right there is opening up to a whole new subsection of people that things like TeamViewer and LogMeIn won't support. They Mac and Windows, yeah, but they don't help support Linux. I don't know. I think they have Android apps. So cool. I came across a question, and I was just roaming around, and I came across this question, and I thought this would be a great one to ask to bring it to Geeksters. The question is if the internet is free, why do I have to pay for domain names? And I thought, that's a great question. I do web hosting. I have a registrar that I go through. So I understand how domain names work, and I understand, you know, the process of bringing up a website and getting it online. But I've never really stopped to say, but if I'm not having to pay for the internet, then why do I have to pay for domain names? It's not as if you can equate that to vehicles. You have to pay for maintenance on a vehicle, yes, but you also have to pay road tax as well. And we may not pay it directly, depending on, you know, whether we rent or buy a home, depending on where you live. But, you know, gas taxes should go to, you know, some of the roads. So we do pay for that. And so it's not like a road, it's the internet. There's not an internet tax yet. So I thought I would bring this. I thought this was a great question. And I thought I'll bring this to Geeksters. So there's four parts that go into domains. There's the registry, the registrars, the registrant, and then ICANN. So we'll start from the top there. The registry is the entity that manages what are called TLDs. You sometimes hear them. They're top-level domains. They're the .coms and the .nets and the .orgs. They're the top-level ones, right? And registries need to be accredited by ICANN in order to sell the names, okay? So sell domain names. Somebody who can sell those are somebody like GoDaddy, VeriSign, Network Solutions, okay? They are what are called, then they are the registrars. Okay, so the registrars sell some of the top-level registries, okay? That's where they're due. So GoDaddy is a registrar that can sell multiple domains, okay? And we've all bought, you know, if you work with GoDaddy or Network Solutions, you're not stuck with just having to buy .com. You can buy org, net, biz, et cetera, okay? Then there's a registrant, and that is who you are. That's me. I'm the registrant. I go to my registrar who sells stuff from ICANN's registry. Does that make sense so far? And then there's ICANN, and they're kind of the body that manages everything. So when you register a domain name, a major portion of the domain name fee, whether it's $10, whether it's $20, whatever the cost is, that goes to the registrar, like GoDaddy, Network Solutions, stuff like that. Then a very small amount of the portion is paid to the registry, which would be, like VeriSign and stuff. And then some of it also goes to ICANN for managing everything. So everybody kind of gets a piece of the pie, and that's why it does cost some. And then the question is, why does then GoDaddy charge me $10 a month or, $10 a year for internet, for domain names, where something like Enom charges you $29.95 a year? Well, that could be a couple things. That could be based on their business model as well. Enom, which is a company I've used for many, many years, they are a little higher, but they don't host at all. They've started in the last couple of years, but originally they did not do any hosting. So they would just sell you the domain name, but they would give you unfettered access to anything you wanted to change on that. Okay. So you paid a little bit more for a lot of that flexibility. I've come into situations where other providers will sell you a domain name for really cheap. You know, buy martinobando.com for $7.95. Oh, that's great. I want to now host martinobando.com on my own servers. Oh, to change the DNS entries to make sure you can point it to where you want to point it to, that's $10. And then to do this other thing, that's another $10. So they will give you a really cheap domain name on the hopes that they're going to make the money back by having you host with them, where somebody like Enom doesn't. They just say, $30, do what you want with it. We're just going to sell you the domain name. You know, you can host with us if you want, and they will give you a discount then if you host. But like, I don't host with my registrar. I have two completely separate things. But I end up paying a little bit more because I want the flexibility of being able to move my sites from host to host without having to worry about the nickel and diming me on the back end for the registrar. So that's just a good question I came across, and I thought I would throw it out to you, to people here who do some web hosting, but then there's a lot of people who don't do web hosting, and they kind of, where does that money go then? You know,
that's it.
There it is. It's pretty simple. It's a business. Everybody's got to take a piece of it, but a majority of the money goes to your registrar, GoDaddy, Enom, Network Solutions, etc. Ta-da!
Well, like anything, it takes infrastructure, and it takes money to make things happen. Why does it cost so much to get this thing that only costs pennies? Well, I mean, there's a lot before, during, and after that to get it to your hands, and somebody has to do that stuff. And so that maybe this isn't the best example of that, but even things that are free, it still takes money to get them into your hands. And so, how about a Linux disk snap? Sure, you can download them free, but if you want one shipped to you, well, it costs a few bucks. Well, why does it cost money for something that's free? Well, it's not free now. You know, somebody had to actually burn it to the disk. It costs money to ship it to you, right? And so you're not paying for the things itself so much as what it took to actually get it into your hands. There is a reasonable amount to pay for a ship to your house. Right? I mean, some folks try and take advantage of that, but actually taking care of the actual delivery and making the thing, getting it to you, I mean, that's worth something.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. Things aren't free. Sometimes if things are free, it's too good.
There you go.
Sometimes. Hugs are free, and they're great.
Hugs are free. But but if you want me to come to your house and give you one, it's going to cost you.
That's big money. Yeah, I don't have
that. That's all about the shipping and handling. The hug is still
that's
free.
All about the shipping that's and handling. It. All right. To get off an uncomfortable subject, a
Did
couple
I
weeks
make
ago,
you
I had mentioned. No, not at all. I'll give you a hug.
Oh, I'd hug you back.
All right.
We'll meet in Iowa somewhere.
All right. There we go. Like Columbus.
Not halfway.
I know Columbus isn't in Iowa either.
I'm confused. All right. Well, just show me on your Google Maps where you were.
Okay. Okay. A couple weeks ago, I ended up having, and I think I mentioned it here, but a client called me up. They had done an update to their printer. It was an HP, and then it just sat in an initializing loop. It would turn on, say initializing, and then reboot. Turn on, initializing, reboot. It's a multifunction printer. It was a mid-range printer, so it was one of the, between $400 and
$500 printer.
Yeah, yeah. And I've had great luck with Brother lately. This was an HP. No worries. So she calls me up, and this is in Albany. And from my house, Albany is an hour and a half one way by car going just a tiny bit over the speed limit. So,
just a tiny bit.
I got to put it out there so you know, if I was to go the speed limit, it would probably take me a little more than an hour and a half.
Yeah, gotcha.
And she calls me up and says, this is what's happening. I have to print some stuff, and I have to print some stuff today. It's a apartment complex. They're having new people come in. They've got, an inch and a half thick of papers that everybody has to sign, when you go to apartment complex. And she needed a printer. So I said, well, okay. So I got a hold of the boss of the company. We need to get a printer. They said, just buy a new one, get it down there, set it up. So I leave my house, go across the street to Office Depot, and then take off down to Albany. And I'm there. I take the other printer, unhook it, put the new printer in, load the drivers, and she's up and running in 25 minutes, and I'm out the door, and I'm back home an hour and a half later. So I think I'm gonna worry about this printer later. And today was that day later. So I brought it up to my office, put it up on the bench, turn it on. Sure enough, it sits in initializing. So I go do some research online, and it says if you're going to do any kind of updates, and this would have been a firmware update, to make sure that you're plugged in via USB, because if there's any network interference or connection loss, then basically you just the update just crashes, and that's what happened. So I went online and looked at the forums, and there was about 15 people asking the forum, hey, this is the problem. And now what HP was doing is they were saying, oh, not a problem. We can tell you how to fix it. Check your personal message. They weren't telling you how to fix it on the forum. So I had to sign up for an HP account. I then had to log in. I then had to say, hey, me too. Could you help me? And they never got back to me. So in the meantime, I thought, I know there has to be, just like every other printer, there has to be some kind of a secret combination judo hand cramping configuration you have to do. And I found it. And I reset the printer. Nice. So on this HP, it was just the two bottom right hand corner ones. One's the X and one's a, I don't know, some sheet feed something, button. Held them down, turned it on, and thought, well, I'll just sit here for a while. And sure enough, it said initializing, and then it didn't reboot, and all of a sudden the screen came up. That was the time, the date, and everything. So I quickly reset the whole printer, got into the firmware. A lot of times you can go into these printers and just do a system reset. Quickly just did a system reset. Went ahead, then downloaded the update to my Windows box, ran an update. It said it didn't need an update. So it's back up and running. I'm going to take it back to the office tomorrow, and they're going to use it as a spare and just deploy it to other people. But if you're going to do any kind of firmware update on printers, I very rarely do firmware updates on printers. I know you should. I know that there are vulnerabilities in printers because they are just another device on your network, and people can have hacked them to be able to use them as devices to get into your system. But I find that printer firmware updates break more than they do fix. At least that's my experience.
It feels like a BIOS update to me, that it seems really worthwhile if you know that it's going to solve an issue that's ongoing or is very likely to occur. If everything's kind of humming along happy, it would have to be a monster exploit and very likely for me to upgrade. Because it's kind of like the odds of it doing something good seems small as opposed to the risk you're running by doing it. And this was something the customer did, right? And
right.
So, that's probably going to go bad.
Well, I mean, we have customers and they'll call us up and they'll say, I'm supposed to do this update. Malwarebytes says I'm supposed to update. Do I update? You say yes. Windows is popping up. Should I update? Yes, please update. Adobe's popping up. Java's popping up. Flash is popping up. Acrobat Reader's popping up. Should I update? And we say, yes, please update, because we know there's security holes. Well, then HP pops up and says, hey, should I update? And we say, yes, 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 all the time. It would just make sense, logically, they would go, well, they would want me to update this. And she did, and it broke. I mean, it's been resolved, and it's been fixed, and she felt really bad, and everybody got a kick out of it to a certain point.
I don't blame the customer, because they don't know. I mean, it really is. It's a tidal wave of crap coming at them. And they all, after a while, all the updates kind of look the same. And which do you click and which don't you? That's our job to know that. They can't keep that.
Right. And so she just said, I won't going to do that again, ever again. Which is fine. And I got it resolved and it's been fixed, but it did, it was time. And it's just something that I just don't normally do. It sounds like Al in the chat room says, I hate printers and faxes. So, if it's my own machine, I'll do the update. But if it's a client's machine, and especially if they're, 3 hours round trip from me, I'll say, no, let's not update that, because if it breaks, then you know, I got a bit of a drive there, and it all worked out.
You know, if you're being prompted to update something with a printer, that tells me there was probably some companion software running with it, right? And to me, that's, unless there's something there they actually need, rarely do I install that, because it usually just leads to further harassment.
Right. It was one of those, I should have used Unchecky, because we went through and we just installed everything in a hurry, and I didn't uncheck the, you know, HP update and all this other kind of stuff, because I was so far away that I gave them the full suite.
Yeah.
So that way, in case something happened later on, I need this one app, I'm in a stuck, I'm in a bind, can we remote in and do it? I gave it to them all. That way, they had it. It's the same reason when I do Office installs. What I'll usually do is I'll copy all the data from the CD and I'll put it in a folder like installs. Yes. On the C drive. And then I'll do a full install of what they need. If it's a student machine, you know, at one of the schools, that I know they don't need Outlook. They don't need, what's the screenshot tool? And there's, yeah, you know, there's all these other kind of things. They don't need Access. OneNote. Thank you. So I'll uncheck those, but then also I'll say, do a full install of everything. And then I'll say, don't install this, don't install this, don't install that. And that way the student has everything they possibly need, because I'm making an image for a whole bunch of machines. And then I have the installer there in case I need to go back on a one-on-one basis to just add on something. So being that it's so far away, that I just did it all. And what happened. I don't know if it really necessarily bit me, because I did have to go down and put a new printer in. But, you know, I guess the moral of the story is, HP does say, if you're going to do any kind of firmware updates on the machines, make sure you're doing USB, not network. And if it's not broke, like you said, for BIOSes, then you probably don't want to update it anyways.
Yeah, that's just kind of the way I feel about it. And installing the printers, you know, if you can't download just the driver, install just the driver. And I'm not beating you up here. I mean, that was just the situation. That's just what happened. And that's why we do what we do. I mean, you're going to have that from time to time. But, you know, it's ideal if when installing a printer, it sure is nice if you can get just the driver. It's not so easy always from from HP. I mean, it's like the disk that comes with it. I just frisbee that as far as I can out of their office. And, you know, I try to find now if I can't get just the driver, well, I download whatever I can get. And then I usually use 7-Zip, and I break that dude open and I find the driver. And then when it's searching for the drivers, I point it to that. And usually you can get away with doing that without having to go through their executable that wants to install all kinds of awful, horrible things.
Right. Yeah.
So, but anyway, good fix. That sounds like something that really got broken, but it wasn't. It just needed a reset.
But I didn't know how to reset it. I just had to just kind of I was one step away from grabbing and just palming the whole control panel so every button was pushed down and then turning it on and seeing what happened. But I didn't have to. I got lucky. That's all it was.
You beat it.
That's right. In your face, HP printer. And then I'm going to take it outside, and we're going to do like Office Space.
Well, you know,
PC load letter.
Most people love those HP printers. You will have trouble getting support for that.
Yeah.
If you hooked it to, if you chained it to the back of your car and drug it an hour and a half back, I have a feeling you'd have about 100 people following you cheering.
There's a line.
Yeah. My turn. Ooh,
wait.
I'm next.
So I came across a couple news articles, and the reason I brought these up is because there's a couple of things that I've talked about that I use, and we've talked about it. We've talked about LastPass as a password password keeper, password
– right.
What do you call that?
Password manager.
Thank you, manager. That's the word I was looking for. The news broke out this week, and this is from TechCrunch. It says LastPass finds security holes in its online password manager, doesn't think anyone exploited them.
No.
Well, and then Steve Gibson probably talked about it today on his podcast, because he tweeted earlier today saying, just a note, the LastPass issues were addressed 10 months ago. Out of respect for the researchers, LastPass waited for their paper's release. So I think they're, and I don't know if that was saying that he was waiting, what is that? I kind of found that to be an interesting comment. He was out of respect for the researchers and what they had found 10 months ago. LastPass didn't admit that there was a hole. I don't know. Found that odd. Anyways, in LastPass, you can use what are called booklets. And booklets are the mobile version of kind of favorites inside of the LastPass manager. There was a that said that Only 1%. It says less than 1% of their user base of LastPass uses booklets. There was a way that you could use an exploit within booklets. There was a one-time password feature. And then there was some other stuff that it just kind of goes through a whole bunch of different stuff. But it says they were discovered in August 2013. So it's been almost a year now since these bugs were done, and LastPass has fixed it. So LastPass says this in response to all this, because they did come out and issue a statement after this was released, and they said, if you're concerned that you've used booklets before September 2013 on a non-trustworthy site, you may consider changing your master password and generating new passwords, although we don't think it's necessary. Regarding the OTP attack, which is the one-time password attack, it is a targeted attack requiring an attacker to know the user's username and to potentially exploit it and serve that account custom attack per user. Potentially exploit it and serve that custom attack per user activity, which we have not seen. So they wanted to release just a statement saying that if you do use LastPass, it sounds like everything is fine. There's nothing to worry about. The big question that really kind of came out of all of this was, that's nice that LastPass really kind of waited till the research stuff, but why didn't they come out originally and just say, it's been fixed, we know these issues, it's been fixed? And so that's something that I mean, I'm a very small fish in a very big pond, and I have zero influence on any kind of technology company at all, but I would prefer that technology companies, when there's a flaw, fixed or not fixed, well, I guess soon as it's fixed, because if it's not fixed, then they're just asking for more trouble. Right. But as soon as a flaw is found and it's fixed, to really release it and say, you know what, we messed up, we're going to take credit for this, it's been patched, we don't feel that we knew about it, we went back, we looked at the logs, we researched everything, and we know that everything has come across clean and we don't know anything about that. So I would just encourage companies to do that. Even if you're a small business owner, you and me, when we make a mistake, we need to just kind of man up and say, we made a mistake. Not, it's been fixed, I'll worry about it later. But really just say, you know, we messed up. You know, it's kind of that whole integrity.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if the mechanic works on my brakes and makes a mistake and the next day catches it and fixes it, I don't want to wait a year to say, hey, there's not a problem, but there was briefly, but nothing happened, so it's okay, right? Well, I just come out and say, hey, we had this issue, it's been resolved, be aware, you know, FYI. And then, you know, there's nothing's required on your part, but feel free to proceed as necessary. And so, and you're like, oh, okay, it's done. But then a year later, it's kind of like, well, that's just weird.
Yeah.
What prompted it now?
Right. Right. Well, do you feel guilty? Did a year pass and you finally said, I think the waters have calmed down enough, or is it publicity? I mean, I hate for it to be publicity.
Did a third party break this information or break the story, or what happened?
I'd have to research it some more and find out. But
it seems a bit anticlimactic, but the story here is, yeah, but hey, you got to tell us when these things happen.
Yeah.
Not like the wizard behind the curtain and everything's okay, right?
Yeah, when it's not really. So, I don't know, just one of those things. What I wanted to bring LastPass up is because I am a big user of LastPass. I have used it for a long time. I really enjoy it. And I used to use, we'd have to go back and research it. I'd have to find it. But on a Podnuts episode, I interviewed one of the developers of LastPass and Xmarks. And what Xmarks is, okay, so years ago when I started using LastPass, I also was using Xmarks. They were two completely separate company. And Xmarks will synchronize, so Xmarks is a third party that will synchronize your bookmarks across multiple platforms on multiple devices, which is nice because you make a change on one, you have them all synced on the other. So that works out well if you're, Nightwise talks about, oh my gosh, it's gone. Cross-platform geeks, you know, so you're maybe on a Windows box at work, but then you use Apple and Linux at home, and you can go across between all of them and all your bookmarks get saved, which is great. So LastPass bought Xmarks, and I hope it's getting better. I haven't used it yet, but this site from Make Use Of is the complete guide to simplifying and securing your life with LastPass and Xmarks. So it goes through the whole process of using Xmarks, what it does, what is it, how to do it, what it, you know. And I need to probably start it again. There was a long time that I used it for quite a while, and the problem I was running into it was is that it wouldn't synchronize, or when it synchronized, it would overwrite everything. So then I have to stop, go back, because it does have a history. I'd go back in my history, clear everything out, re-import back from history. So I always had this, and always they were always in conflict. So I'm gonna go ahead and give it a shot again, and just try it and see how it works. So there is one thing though that I'll have to research that. I don't want to say that. I'll bring it up next show. But so stay tuned for a possible giveaway. But check this out. If you are cross-platform, if you're using multiple applications, if you're using or multiple systems, even multiple browsers, this will simplify your passwords. And you can set work passwords and home passwords, groups essentially. So you can differentiate between the two within Xmarx itself. So thought I would bring that up.
That's a good addition to them. I mean, you know, with LastPass, it's a password manager, but actually having companion software from them that, you know, then goes ahead and syncs up all that, everything else from your browser, you know, bookmarks and whatnot. That was a pretty clever move.
Yeah. And I remember when I spoke to the developer, I asked him about Xmarx and he goes, well, you know, I said, is this, you're doing a lot to increase Xmarx, or I mean, excuse me, a lot to increase LastPass on mobile, and you're moving all around. It's growing in popularity and you're putting a lot of effort into it. I said, how are you guys doing on Xmarx? And he goes, well, I don't know. And so I don't, you know, maybe it's getting better. Maybe they've put more man hours into Xmarx. I'm going to give it another shot again just to see, because I do have, you know, I have Firefox and Chrome on this here. I've got Chrome on my phone and, you know, I'm going to give it a shot.
We want a full report.
I will give you a full report. Right. The last one I wanted to bring up, and this was, I just saw this today, and this is from Code 42. Code 42 is the parent company for CrashPlan. And CrashPlan is the backup offsite cloud-based storage that I really, really enjoy. I use them. They're a great product. MIT today selected them as their, it says, Code 42, the leader in endpoint data protection and management, today announced that Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a premier institution of higher learning for sciences, engineering, and technology, selected CrashPlan for Enterprise to protect and manage the university's end user data. So MIT is going with CrashPlan. If that's not like the giant, not just a feather, but like the whole eagle in somebody's hat, that MIT actually selects them to do their endpoint backup, that's a big plus in CrashPlan's, you know, that's a big notch in their belt.
Yeah, you think so? That's pretty good. That's something to brag about.
Yeah. Buddy. So I'll throw that in. I wanted to throw that in there. It's, you know, it's not a huge news story other than the fact that it's big for MIT. It's big for CrashPlan. But I like CrashPlan. I use them. I use them a lot and really like them. Back to the Xmarx syncs. Al in the chat room says that I must turn off bookmark sync in Chrome for it to stop. It overwrites. So that may be the problem, is that you have to let Xmarx, if you're going to use Xmarx, it has to be the syncing tool. You can't have Firefox bookmark sync and Chrome bookmark sync. And I may have had the Chrome bookmark sync turned on because I wanted to protect it twice. And that may have just been thrashing the whole thing. So thanks, Al. I will definitely try it again and turn that off, because I know that I have Chrome sync on right now, because when I reload my computer, I can just log in and all my bookmarks come down. So I'm going to have to turn
that off. That's a good point. I also have my Firefox set up to sync between computers and devices, and it's always been very good. But that's a good point. You may disable it. It's probably the trick to getting a third-party app working properly.
Right. And I didn't mention the price of it. The Xmarx will do so you get free bookmark. It's free. But I think there's a $12 a year plan that you get LastPass and Xmarx, the premium edition. But anyways, Xmarx works on the iPhone, Android, Windows, Dolphin, BlackBerry, if you got a BlackBerry, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So yeah, that's what Al says. It kept overwriting for me until I changed it, and that's what to do. Okay, that's my problem. I will turn it off, and then I will do it again. Ice cream truck's here.
Yeah.
The window's closed, but I hear it. So we're you know, it's summertime, and when Geekster's on and the ice cream truck rolls around, it's like old times. So that's what I mean. We've that's what I got.
Yeah,
today.
I got one more thing I want to throw out.
Please.
This doesn't affect too many of our listeners, but there was an iOS version of Ingress released yesterday. Now, this is something I've been threatened to do forever. Finally, did it. If you play just be aware that it's available. You know, if you don't, you have an iOS device, try it out. And, you know, all I'll say is that it is finally out. And if you do choose to take a look at the game, I'd recommend choosing the Resistance. Of course, the Enlightened, you would not want to do that. But the game is simple enough that you can kind of, you know, tinker around with it. It does require you to leave the house, get out and about. And if it's easy enough that you can kind of play a little bit, enjoy yourself. There are enough nuances of it, though, and strategy that you play it forever and never really get, never really kind of get to the end of it, how to be the best strategy. But if you have any trouble, wherever you are in the world, there's probably a G+ group in your community that's doing this, and I'd recommend send me questions, but definitely join your G+ community. It's a wonderful game. It's fantastic. You get out, you meet fantastic people, and you learn things about your community that you would never ever know or see. It's the things that I have gotten out of this game. I could never have possibly predicted. So it's made me a much better member of my community, much more aware of its history, and I have friends for life. So
a closer relationship with your local police department?
Oh, not just the local one. I mean, I've got new friends in local law enforcement all over the place. So I don't think that's kind of the more, you know, that's more the seemlier side of the thing. It's Ingress doesn't close. It's open 24 hours a day, and sometimes, you know, the authorities don't think that you should be in certain places of town stopped at certain times. I'm just kind of a simple rube. I don't think it. So anyway, let's not go that route. But I did want to mention that. They've been threatening to do it forever. They finally did it yesterday. It's out. So FYI.
Well, I've never, that was one of the first things I looked at when I got my new Android was, oh, Ingress. And I was like, I don't know. I know that if I start, that's all I'm going to do.
So don't start.
I'll never come home. That's right. So that's why I haven't started yet. I do some geocaching, and that's it. You know, that's enough. That's kind of like ingressing, but not. But I have Google Maps. But I have Google History to tell me where I've been.
Right.
So.
Well, anyway, just wanted to mention that. Plus, I want Fred to come back on here and yell at me. So, Fred, Ingress, get out there, Fred, and Ingress more. And if Fred doesn't come back on the show soon, I'm going to do like a whole episode of just Ingress, just to make him mad.
And call everybody Fred. Everybody's Fred. Well, Tim, if people want to get a hold of you about ingressing questions,
how can you do that? Yeah, buddy. I'm Tim Bauermeister on the G+. You can also search on the G+ for Agent N Like Tim. You'll find me. And those are both linked to the same account. But that's the easiest, best way to get me is the G+. And that's what I would do. That's where you'll find me.
Wait, you had a false G+ name?
No. Oh. No. It's it is Tim Bauermeister. However, you, I think it was maybe, I don't know, 9-12 months ago, Google Plus offered the option of adding a quote-unquote nickname or something to your account. And so you can search for either, and they will lead you both to the same account, which is me.
Oh, because Google Plus today just allowed you to not use your real name. So I thought maybe you had two accounts.
No, nothing like that.
Tim and then the real Tim.
Let's not confuse them.
Okay, not confused. If people want to get a hold of me directly, they can call, well, they can't call, but they can email me, martin@obandocomputing.com. I am Maskill in the chat. I am M. Obando. You can look for M. Obando in the Google+. Any one of those two, you'll find me somewhere. If you just want to email everybody, the whole Geeksters crew, the staff, everybody behind the scene, our support staff, our makeup, our caterer, our... The other people who do things that I don't even know what their names, like the guys who hold the sound. What are those? The gaffers?
There's a boom operator here somewhere.
Yeah. So if you want to email any of them, you can email us all at the same. It's geeksters@podnuts.com. If you want to send our makeup person, somebody who combs out my beard, a voicemail, 707-6-PODNUT, 707-6-PODNUT. You probably won't answer, but it's worth a shot.
Or the primate that picks the nits out of mine.
There we go. Today I'm thinking I'm just about ready to shave this thing off.
I'm getting close, buddy. I'm getting close.
I think my wife would freak, but I'm just about done. So anyways, are you there to just take it way down? It's getting a little... I talk and I end up hitting it with my mic.
Yeah, it's because it has to come off or I'm going to have to braid it because it's unmanageable at this point.
Yeah, so guys and gals, everybody in the chat, thanks for coming and hanging out with us. Thanks for watching us live. Thanks for the downloads and the upvotes and the podcasts and the retweets and all that kind of stuff. Guys, have a great fiscal week, and we'll see you next Tuesday. Bye, guys.
D72 is here. Go to foolishit.com for more information.